An association can empower you or disempower you. Like if at some point you linked up that the only failure is the failure to try, don't you think that association would overall empower you in your life? Similarly, if you linked up that you should avoid trying anything new because you're likely to fail and you hate failure, don't you think that that association would overall disempower you in your life? You need to remember that the stronger of an emotional state you are in, the stronger that anchor will become over time. Remember back to when I was talking about how the anticipation of a sour food may get you to already experience that sensation even before you eat it? Well, the more sour the food is, the more intense your reaction will be. Now, let's connect that sourness to an anchor. So let's say you wanted to run an experiment. You take two groups where they sit down and they stare at a computer screen. And every 30 seconds, a random color will flash on the screen. For every color other than the color red, both groups will take a drink of water. However, when the color red flashes, both groups will have to take a sip of lemon juice. But here's the difference. Group 1 is drinking straight lemon juice, 100% lemon juice, whereas group 2 is drinking, let's say, 25% lemon juice. So it'll be 1 part lemon juice and 3 parts water. Let's say you repeated this experiment for a couple hours every day for several days. By the end of it, what do you think will happen when the subjects see the color red? They will likely experience a sensation of sourness in their mouth. However, do you think they will both experience the sensation at the same level? I think not. The subjects who were consuming straight lemon juice would have developed a stronger association and therefore would have a stronger reaction. Also, their anchor will likely last longer. While it may take a few days for the group who is drinking watered-down lemon juice to get over that anchor, the group which was consuming straight lemon juice will likely maintain that anchor for a longer period of time. You also need to be aware that the anchor will be stronger and develop quicker when the association is more unique. All right, what do I mean? Well, the subjects in our experiment could have also developed an anchor to the computer screen they were looking at, or the laboratory they were driving to every day, or the scientist they were dealing with, and they very well may have. It is entirely possible that on the fourth day of driving to the laboratory, the subject, pulls into the parking lot, is about to walk in the laboratory door, and they experience that sourness. Or perhaps as soon as they enter the testing room, or as soon as they look at the computer screen, they experience that sourness. But the more unique and direct the association is, the stronger and quicker that anchor will come. Just like how if you are with a girl, sometimes you can have a couple bad days at work in a row, and if every day it's the same, you come home, you sit down, you turn on the TV, she enters, tries to talk to you, that association will develop faster than if, say, you had one bad day at work, and then you saw her at home. And then you had a couple good days at work, and you saw her, and you had positive experiences with her. And then maybe a week later, you had another bad day at work. But this time, instead of meeting her at home, you met her out for dinner. And then you went home after you had dinner outside together. And then you had a couple more good days at work and built more positive associations with her. And then you have another bad day at work. But when you get home this time, maybe she wasn't home. And then you're home for several hours alone. And then she comes home. Can you see how it would be a lot harder for your brain to develop that association if it was taking place that way? So tell me, what are the most important associations you could create which would empower you to achieve your goals? What are the associations you would need to create financial prosperity, to build a powerful business, a healthy and energized body, a strong and stable relationship? And what are some of the negative associations you have which are hindering you from achieving those goals? So, now it's time for today's exercise. Hey, today is an easy one. Tomorrow we've got a little bit more going on, but today we're just getting you ready. So, here's what I want you to do. I need you to think of two positive associations you have developed over the course of your life which have shaped it for the better. And then I also want you to think of two negative associations you have developed which are hindering you in your life today. Now, the truth is, it's more important for us to think about those negative associations because that's where we're really going to see dramatic improvement in our life when we begin to change them. So, you have some examples. I'll go ahead and tell you some of, my positive associations as well as some of my negative associations I'm currently battling. And listen, hey, it would be easy for me to sit here and pretend like I'm all perfect and I fixed everything in my life, but no, I am always trying to improve it. When I fix, I'll take a priority thing. I'm like, listen, what are the worst things going on in my life right now? And I'll try and improve upon that. And then when I get that done, I'll move on to the next thing. And when I get that done, I'll move on to the next thing. No matter where I am, I know that there will always be room for improvement. I know I can always be better. Heck, that's probably a positive association that I have. I believe that I can always be better. I can always do more. All right, I can always strengthen these positive associations, and I can continually look for the negative associations, and I can weaken them. That belief that I can always improve is a positive association in and of itself. But it's not the one that we're talking about, okay? So, my first positive association is I have conditioned myself year after year to believe that I can learn anything so long as I put in enough time and effort. I honestly don't care what it is. I believe at the emotional gut level, I believe that I can achieve relative greatness at virtually anything if I try hard enough for long enough. Now, mind the language there. I said relative greatness. I don't necessarily believe that I could be the number one best in the world at anything I do. There are certain limitations which even at the emotional level I understand. But I do not believe that I can't be a part of the elite group on this earth if I put the work in and I put the time and effort in. And mind you, this may not even be true. I'm sure in reality, if I was to think about it intellectually, there's probably a lot of things that I cannot do. But I don't feel that way. My intellectual mind can understand that I'm sure I have certain limitations. I don't know what they are. I try not to focus on them. But my emotional being, my gut, believes that I am capable of learning anything to a very, very high level. My second positive association that I've built, and this one was a very conscious association that I've built, is the belief that I have 100% control and responsibility over my life. Growing up, it is natural for most children to feel like they are being controlled by their parents and school staff and adults in general. And as a child, this is more or less true. Being a child is, you don't have a lot of freedom, okay? They don't have the same legal rights that adults have. Children cannot do a lot of things without their parents' permission. In many areas, they have curfews. I'm not talking about the ones enforced by their parents. I mean enforced by the city. They have curfews. Children have many restrictions such as the inability to vote or smoke or drink or sign a legally binding document. That's kind of relevant. When you can't sign a legally binding document, that restricts basically everything that you can do in your life, including things like renting an apartment or a car. Even if the kid could find some, person willing to rent to them, they cannot legally live on their own. Even if they can afford it and they find someone to rent to them, they cannot legally leave their parents unless a judge emancipates them. And let's not forget that parents can legally beat their children in most countries, including America. Heck, in some states in America, even teachers can legally beat children. So yes, as a child, we do have many more external restrictions which can influence our life. The problem is that as most of us grow up, and we gain much larger control over our life, we still feel as though we're just this little child and we have no control over our lives. I had to constantly remind myself growing up when I was, you know, I moved out when I was 17, illegally, by the way, because I wasn't emancipated, but I moved out when I was 17, I found someone who was willing to rent to me, and I maybe had to pay a little bit in advance because, you know, you can't sign legally binding documents, but I was able to, at that age, when I was 17, 18, 19, I had to keep telling myself, hey, listen, I'm an adult now, I don't have those same restrictions that I used to have. I have control over my life. And once again, of course, in reality, even as an adult, there are still some external influencing factors, but it is unhealthy to give up your power. Even if something is probably less your fault than it is your fault, you still want to look for excuses to take ownership over your circumstance. This constant reassurance has built an impenetrable wall for me. Sometimes I may be telling friends or family how I'm feeling so lazy because I see other individuals who are accomplishing so much more than I am, and while they may try to make me feel better by telling me that that person has been doing it longer than I have, or they had some form of a head start in life, or some sort of an unfair advantage over me, not necessarily unfair, but they just had an advantage over me, I refuse to accept any of those answers. The only answer that I am willing to accept is I am not working hard enough. Because that's the only answer that I have control over. I cannot control if somebody else came from money, or maybe has a little bit more intelligence than I do, or is in, you know, has better connections than I do. I cannot control that. And it's disempowering to you to focus on that. The only thing which I can control is how hard I work. That's it. So that's what I focus on. So tell me this. If that is the belief that I hold, do you think that I am going to be more or less willing to increase my work output compared to someone who says that they are not seeing the same level of success someone else is because the other person's parents were supporting them financially for several years when they moved out, while I had to work for myself, such a poor baby, let me feel sorry for myself and support myself. And therefore, I had less time to work on my content, my true passion projects, whereas the other person had all this time to do it. Who do you think is going to be more willing to increase their work output? The person who says, listen, I'm not working hard enough. That's the one and only reason. That's all I'm going to focus on. That is the only truth I am willing to accept. Do you think that person's going to work harder, or he's just going to give up? Compare that to the person who feels sorry for themselves and puts excuses that are outside of their realm of control. That person who says, oh, well, this other person, he's seeing certain successes that I'm not, but it's unfair because his daddy was this person, or he, you know, when he was young, he saw this success, or he started earlier than I did, or whatever it is. Do you think that person is actually going to go out and increase their output? Are they going to go out and produce results in the real world? Or are they going to continue whining and complaining like a little baby while doing nothing? I can tell you actually a very recent example where this took place. I have noticed over the past couple years that a disproportionately large percentage of the ultra-successful people claim that they only sleep about 4, maybe 5 hours a day. couple or more notable people that you may be familiar with are some like Donald Trump, Jay Leno, Thomas Edison, Martha Stewart, Benjamin Franklin, the Twitter and Square founder Jack Dorsey, and my personal fave, CNBC Mad Money host Jim Cramer, who regularly talks on his show about how sleeping less allows him to accomplish more. Recently, I started paying more and more attention to this trend, and it makes complete sense. If you are currently working a full-time job, and that job is not part of your long-term vision, and you have, say, a few other obligations, maybe, you know, a family that you're taking care of, then you may only have a few hours a day that you can dedicate to your passion project. Let's say you have 4 hours a day after your full-time job, getting ready for that, going to it, coming back, eating and doing your normal chores you have to do, taking care of your family, and that's a lot of stuff, and sleeping, right? So let's say you got 4 hours a day that you can dedicate to that passion project. Now, if you were able to sleep, say, only 4 hours a night instead of 7, or sleep 5 hours instead of 8, you have just like that. You've increased the amount of time that you're putting into your long-term goals by 75% a day. You're going from 4 hours to 7 hours like that. It makes complete logical sense that sleeping less would give you a tremendous advantage. Here's the catch. Only 5% of the population can do this. Scientists have located a mutation in the gene DEC2, which allows for people to sleep much more efficiently than others. So people with this gene mutation will wake up after about 4 or 5 hours of sleep and feel just as rested as if the other 95% of the population wakes up after about 8 hours of sleep. I do not have this gene mutation. Now, I find that if I'm getting less than about 7 hours of sleep a night, I have a lot of trouble performing at a competent level throughout the day. But 7 hours, that's like the minimum that I can do. On most hours, I am sleeping about 8 hours a day, and sometimes it can be up to even 8.5 hours a day. So I told my mom this, and she of course did what moms do and told me how it was okay and that I was doing such a good job and that I couldn't change how I was born. Well, that's wonderful, and I love my mom and how positive she is, and sometimes I need to hear that, but that didn't give me the answer that I was looking for. I'm looking for a result here. How can I sleep less hours per day and still be effective throughout the day? So I started looking into it and began experimenting. First with caffeine. I had never drank coffee before, and then I tried that. You know, I previously didn't really believe in coffee. I didn't really like it. But then I did some research, and I was like, oh yeah, it's not as bad as I originally thought it was. Gave it a try. It helped out a bit, but you know, the fact of the matter is, if I can already get up and make the coffee, I usually have enough energy to just be up. It's the getting out of the bed part that's the hard part, so that didn't really help out originally. Then I started experimenting with a much louder alarm clock, and I hooked my phone actually up to like a loudspeaker, and that was quite effective of getting me out of bed, and I put that kind of on the other side of the room. But I still had issues in terms of staying awake throughout the day and effective, although that's when caffeine was a little bit more effective in terms of keeping me a little bit more effective throughout the day. I then started researching sleeping patterns, and this was where I found a little bit more success. In short, the more you nap throughout the day, the less total time you have to sleep in a 24-hour period. So if you normally sleep 8 hours a night, but then you add in a 1 hour nap, you might only need to sleep, say, 6.5 hours at night, and then your total net throughout the day is going to be 7.5 hours, and you're going to save 30 minutes. Now, that may not sound like a huge deal, but if you only have, you know, 3 hours a day to work on your passion project, well, that's an increase of 18%, and that's a pretty significant jump. Or if you were to take 2 1-hour naps, or maybe a 90-minute nap and a 30-minute nap, you may only need to have a core night sleep of 4.5 hours. That would give you a net savings of 90 minutes of sleep a day. Now, fortunately, I am in a situation today where I am self-employed, so I have a little bit more control over my sleeping schedule than if I was working a standard full-time job. I did find this to be an effective way to decrease and shave off the amount of time that I was sleeping every night, but even, you know, in addition to that, it decreased in a big way my insomnia, so I was saving extra time there, and it increased my ability to wake up swiftly in the morning and get to work, so I was able to get to work faster. Now, there were a few other sleeping techniques that I researched and implemented, like going to bed at a consistent time and waking up at a consistent time, and increasing my exposure to natural light in the morning helped a lot. So I started sleeping with the blinds open instead of the blinds closed, and then in the morning that natural light is just blasting in, and it totally helps me wake up with so much more energy. Now, I'm currently sleeping around 6.5 hours a day, and that's still obviously a far cry from 4 hours a day or 5 hours a day, but it's way better than that 7 to 8.5 hours a day that I was previously doing, especially when you factor in that I get more quality sleep because I have less insomnia and I'm getting to work quicker. I'm probably saving 15 to 20 minutes a day in the morning because I'm getting to work quicker. And then when I do take my nap, that helps me refocus in the middle of the day, and that increases my work output after my nap. So the differences may not sound huge individually, but when they're all added up, the change has helped me produce, I'd say, maybe about 10% more content every day, which, once again, may not seem like that significant of a difference, but, I mean, when you extrapolate that through a career of many decades, I mean, that difference, a 10% performance difference, is enormous. And I believe in the future that if I so desire to, I can revisit this and I can become even more efficient with my sleep. But right now, I got, you know, the kind of sleeping the 7.5 to 8.5 hours a day that I was doing, that was a big problem for me. Now that I'm down to about that 6.5 hour period, I feel better about it, so it's not my highest priority right now. I'm focusing on more pressing matters, but if I want to, I can always go back to it. The point is this: while I may not be part of that 5% that has the DEC2 gene mutation, my mind had a strong association that I have control over my body, control over my brain, and control over my life. And I also had the association that I could learn anything, which if I put in the time and effort to, I can become good at. So while I did not get down to 4 or 5 hours, I did make a large improvement over my previous situation, and that was all because I had those positive associations. But what about the bad ones? What about those limiting associations that we have which inhibit us from living our life to our full potential? I'll tell you that I am currently battling with some. The first is that at some point in the past, I linked up that I am incapable of multitasking. I had told myself firmly since I was in high school that I can only do one thing at a time. Now, I have told myself that I can do that one thing at a much greater ability and a much higher focus than most people, but that I couldn't multitask. Now, where the situation got even worse was that I did some research during that time. To be perfectly honest, I can't really remember the details anymore. But I did some research, and it essentially confirmed there was some scientific data which was supporting the idea that people... It wasn't necessarily about people, but it was a concept that the greater that you focus on one subject, the more, kind of like when you get in the zone, you know, if you're doing something, you get in that zone where it kind of becomes automatic and you get really deeply into something that you're doing at that time. And the data was showing that the more you get into that zone, the harder it becomes for your brain to transition quickly out of it. So if you're multitasking, you can kind of bounce from subject to subject if you're doing them all on the surface level. You can do easy things like you can go from doing laundry to doing dishes to making an unimportant phone call to watching TV, right? You can kind of multitask doing things that you're not really that in depth with. But when you start doing something at a very deep focused level, it's harder for your brain to transition out of it, which does make a little bit of sense. So when I read that, I'm like, oh yeah, I wanted to believe that I couldn't multitask, because that made it sound to me that I had this superhuman ability to focus. And for what I was doing, I was playing poker at that time. That does require a very intense, deep focus on that one subject, and I wasn't doing anything else at that point in my life. I wasn't going to school at that time. I mean, well, part of it I was, but I wasn't really focusing on school. There was nothing else that I really cared about that much in my life, so I didn't need to multitask. And I just started to believe more and more, hey, I can focus on one thing very, very deeply, but I can't do multiple things. Fast forward to today, and for the very first time, I am in a situation where I believe that I need to multitask. In the past, the way that I operated was I would work hard for a period of time in terms of financially. I'd work hard in terms of gaining money. I'd save up money, and then I would take a break from work, and I would work on some sort of a passion project. Now, those have changed drastically throughout the years, but that's what I would do. I'd work for 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever it was, I'd save up money, and then I'd take time off and I'd work on a passion project, but I would never overlap the two because I couldn't multitask. It was, all right, I'm going to focus on saving money, and now I'm going to focus on my passion project. However, there were some issues with that, meaning I personally am fine with living frugally during the times when I am not working and doing my passion projects. But for obvious reasons, this would create some issues in the relationship I was in at that time, right? So most of the time, like, I'm dating a girl, I'm making money, I'm taking her out to do things, everything's good, and then all of a sudden I quit my job, I stop making money, and I start trying to do some esoteric artistic thing like write a screenplay. And most of the time, the girlfriend's kind of like, yeah, no thank you, bye-bye, right? So, I mean, in all reality, most girlfriends do have a difficult time coping with their significant other randomly quitting their job to sit at home in their underwear and do something, you know, like write a screenplay or learn how to do jujitsu or to be a DJ or I was even a magician for a while. Like, I've done some kind of weird things. And then, of course, when you're not taking the girl out on dates and you're not spending some money on her, I'm not talking about like a high maintenance woman. I'm just saying you take her out to dinner once in a while. You go and you get some coffee. You just go do kind of little small things that cost a couple dozens of dollars, not that much money. But if you don't have any money coming in, I mean, you're going to be kind of a penny pincher because I would want to span out that time where I'm not working so I can focus on my passion project as long as possible. So I didn't want to spend any money. Obviously, that can create issues in a relationship. It's totally understandable that they weren't doing anything wrong. It was me. After getting dumped by a couple girlfriends, I started to see a pattern. Okay, don't do this anymore. So this time around, that association finally became more strong, meaning the association that, hey, if I quit my job, if I quit my income to do my passion project, I'm going to lose my girlfriend. That association became stronger than my association to avoid multitasking. And I kind of like my girlfriend. I don't want her to leave me. So this time around, I was like, all right, I'm at a point where I'm ready. You know, I've got money saved up. I could quit my job if I wanted to. But I said, no, I need to keep the income coming in, and I have to work on my passion project and keep the income coming at the same time. So I decided to do the dreaded multitask. And I'm gonna admit, it's hard for me to work and to multitask and also create these audiobooks, but it's what I needed to do. And I had a difficult time with the first couple audiobooks in terms of, alright, when am I doing my sales job, when am I making the money, and then when am I transitioning over, and which one has a higher priority at different times. But every single day I am strengthening my positive associations to multitasking as well as weakening my negative associations. To weaken my negative associations, I look to great business leaders who I have great admiration for, who have to wear many hats and still are extremely effective. I look at Elon Musk, a guy I look up to so much, who simultaneously runs Tesla and SpaceX. I'm not talking about like they have to wear different hats in the same organization. I mean like this dude is literally running two completely different multi-billion dollar companies at the same time. I look at a guy like Jack Dorsey who is simultaneously running Twitter and Square. Now, I should note that Elon does openly admit that it's not a good idea to, you know, try and start two companies at the same time and to be simultaneously try to actively run two companies at the same time, but he was effectively pushed into the situation where Tesla was failing and the investors were more willing to come on board if he was the one running the company. He was already running SpaceX. Now, when I see that, when I see men who are simultaneously running multiple billion-dollar companies, how the heck am I supposed to say that I can't run my day-to-day, you know, little sales job making a couple grand a month, you know, while simultaneously making an audiobook? Really? It's like, really, Knight Rider? You can't do that when Elon Musk can run Tesla and SpaceX at the exact same time? When you look at it this way, I think my old belief is pathetic. That's silly. Now, don't get me wrong. The second it makes financial sense to quit the day job, to, you know, once I can start covering all of my bills with the audiobooks, yeah, I'm gonna stop doing that because this is my passion project. This I see the good long-term potential for. But until then, I have to multitask, and so I'm continually looking to those guys so I can say, hey, if they can do it, I have no excuse to not do it. The second negative association I am currently working on is the belief that I am a night owl. You know, I'm just like, I'm a nighttime type of person, no pun intended there. My entire life, I have always been most productive after 11 p.m. I know that at least some of you out there listening to this are going to be able to kind of, you know, you're going to be able to compare to what I'm saying. You're going to understand it. You're going to get it. You're like, yeah, it's me too. Like, I'm a nighttime guy. I'm a night owl. I get it, right? The association is quite clear. Without consciously controlling it, I happen to be more productive at nighttime. Therefore, I started associating myself to being more productive at night and calling myself a night owl. Here's the problem. That's bullcrap. I'm not more productive at night. I'm just a procrastinator. That's like saying, oh yeah, I'm more productive when I've waited to the last minute to do something. I'm more productive after I've procrastinated till I don't have time to procrastinate anymore. It doesn't make sense. It's all, see, once I really thought about it and once I wanted to change my association, I was able to see right through it and go, that's complete BS. I do nothing all day long and then nighttime comes and I realize I'm running out of hours and the pain of the procrastination outweighs the pain of whatever it is that I want to do. Therefore, I begin working. Then I get in the zone and I don't want to stop and I stay up multiple hours past my bedtime. And then, of course, that screws up my sleeping schedule, and then I wake up later in the day, and I'm less effective during the day the next day, because, you know, my sleep schedule's messed up, and I'm tired, I'm groggy. I've been much better about this lately since, you know, my sleep schedule is better, kind of what I was talking about early, getting my sleep schedule where I'm going to bed at a more consistent time, waking up at a more consistent time, having the natural light, the naps, but I still catch myself from time to time being kind of like, oh yeah, I'm a night owl, I'm a nighttime person, and I need to remind myself, no. You're not a nighttime person. You're just lazy. You're a procrastinator. A night owl is a lazy person who wants an excuse to not be effective during the day. The vast majority of highly successful people wake up early, typically very early, and they get stuff done. They get accomplishing things immediately. They get out of the bed and they get to work. And they continue working throughout the entire day and into the night. They're not daytime people. They're not nighttime people. They just accomplish stuff whenever they're awake. That's what they do. They wake up and they start working. And so I look at that and I'm like, oh yeah, that's what I gotta do. See, I'm not a nighttime person. I'm just a person who accomplishes things when I am awake. And I try to sleep less so I can be awake more and accomplish more. Now, I do want to have a little side note here. I have absolutely nothing against, anybody else that out there who calls themselves a nighttime person. I'm totally cool with that. And especially for some types of jobs, it makes a lot more sense, if you are awake during the night. I totally get that. The point I'm trying to get across is that I'm trying to make that change, right? So if I'm trying to change myself from saying I'm a nighttime person to now I'm a early bird gets the worm and try and get stuff, the most important stuff done in the day early on and then continue working throughout the night. If I want to adopt those new beliefs, it helps if I bring on new ideologies, new ways of thinking which support that new belief. So, those are some of the positive and negative associations that I have that I'm working on right now. Now it's time for you to think of your own positive and negative associations. I want you to think of at least two positive and two negative associations that you currently have. And remember, be super honest about your negative ones, because I promise you, you do have the power to change them if you so desire, but you can't consciously change them if you don't even recognize that they exist. So today, think about what they are, and then tomorrow we are going to go in depth about how to change them. But the truth is, even just in today's program, you should have already put together enough to give you a couple ideas on how to change them, right? If you have a limiting association, what do you need to do? Well, first of all, you need to become aware of it, conscious of it. Then you need to have the desire to change it. Then, you ever talk to someone who's like a smoker, right? And they know they smoke, they know it's bad, but they don't want to change. They're like, I'm fine. They don't care. Okay. You have to want to care. You gotta want to change it. Then you need to decrease your positive association to it. Just as I decided that, hey, I'm not a night owl. Look at all these successful guys. I must just be procrastinating. All right. And then you need to increase your positive association to the new target. Just as I started looking towards business people who I admire, who start getting things accomplished very early in the morning, such as Elon Musk or Donald Trump. But honestly, you can insert the large majority of these ultra successful people here, and they also will be getting stuff done early in the morning. So that's your task for today. It's a quick one. It will only take a couple minutes, most likely, and you can do it in your head if you want, but I would recommend that after you do it in your head, you at least jot it down so you can remember the associations that you choose for tomorrow's work, all right? That's it, guys. Get it done. Get it done as soon as this audio is over, all right? And then you can go out and have a kick-ass day. Do not take today for granted. You can accomplish so much in one day if you truly put the effort in. We can make new money and make new relationships. We can do a lot of things over. We can lose so much stuff and we can get it back. But the one thing that we will never, ever, ever get back is time. Do not waste the gift of time that you have in front of you today. Remember, success is nothing but a person who has had a long enough string of successful days. If you were successful, say, yesterday and the day before, and you're successful today, and you're successful tomorrow, eventually that string is going to build up long enough and you're no longer going to be counting the days. You're just going to be successful. That's how you're going to live. You're just going to live your day-to-day life successful and you will become successful. I love you guys, I believe in you guys, and as always, live by design. Cue the motivational music. It's day 4. Congratulations on making it this far. I admire your commitment to increase the quality of your life. Never underestimate the power of one day. People around you may not see a difference in your life yet. Heck, even you may not see a big difference in your life yet. But this is how we create change. This is how we change our life for the better. We take it one day at a time, and we continually ask ourselves, what can I do today? What can I accomplish today? How can I make today successful? If you ask yourself simple questions like these every day, and then put in the work, you will get to where you want to be, and one day all of those haters and people who didn't believe that you could do it will look up to you and ask, "How'd you do it, Knight Rider?" And you will know the answer is you took action, massive amounts of action, day after day after day, and you created the life you've always dreamt of out of thin air. So yesterday we learned some of the basics about neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, and your task for the day was to think of 2 positive and 2 negative associations you have created over the years. It was a pretty easy task, so I'm just going to assume that we went ahead and we already did it, right? Okay, good. So, today we're going through the step-by-step process of really applying NLP into our lives. Now, yesterday we touched on the subject of reality versus subjectivity. Do you remember we used the example of 2 people who go through the exact same experience of going to the gym, working out, and then having sore muscles a day or two later? The difference was that one person interpreted this soreness as pain, where the other person interpreted this soreness as pleasure. So what I want you to realize and understand is that to a large degree, how we experience life is a matter of subjectivity, not reality, because it's in our mind. What's happening in reality doesn't matter. All that matters is how we are interpreting things. It is less the events which transpire and happen to us, but more how we interpret those events. So you may be telling yourself the story, you want more money, or you want a better body, or to build a more successful business, or a more loving relationship, or a better connection to God, but realize that what you actually want is none of that. What you really want is a change in how you feel about those things and the way that you think about those things. When you really think about it, doesn't that make sense? Okay, let me give you an example. Ladies, when you say you want a more loving relationship, are you really saying that you want a guy to bring you flowers and tell you you're pretty? Okay, maybe that was a bad example. No, is it? I kid. But do you actually want the reality of those actions, or do you want how those actions will make you feel? Meaning, does possession of chopped up dying vegetation actually like turn you on? Does that serve you in any way? Or is it that at some point in your life, you associated a guy giving you flowers as a gesture of love? And at some point in your life, you associated, ooh, flowers are pretty and I like them. I mean, after all, aren't there women who don't like flowers? Aren't there women who don't like being given flowers? They may think of it as cheesy or fake, or they just don't really care for flowers in general and are annoyed that you wasted money on flowers when you could have like brought them food. And I know some of y'all ladies, you're like, okay, now you're starting to talk my language, Knight Rider. Screw the flowers, bring me pizza and tell me I'm pretty, okay? But look, joking aside, the only reason that we want these things is because we think that it will give us a certain feeling. What we really want is the feeling, okay? The flowers we think will make us feel good, or the pizza will fill up our tummy and, you know, release endorphins and change the state of our body, and that will make us feel good, okay? We don't actually want the pizza. We want the way that the pizza is gonna feel in our mouth, right? We want that feeling. Okay, or being told we're pretty, we think will make us feel good. But that's just one person's associations. As I've already said, some women hate flowers. Some women who are dieting will hate you if you bring home a big old pizza. I mean, could you imagine if you're like, all right, I got this pool party or this like wedding that I'm going to for a friend to be the best maid or whatever it is, and you're like, I'm dieting and I'm gonna fit in that bikini, and you're like so close, you're almost there, and then your boyfriend comes home with a freaking pizza and you're like, I hate you, right? So it's not that we want the pizza or that we want the flowers, we just want a certain feeling. But even our own associations can change from time to time. Okay, or take the, you know, being told that we're pretty. Some women absolutely love that. But some women, aren't there women who don't like being praised for their beauty? Aren't there entire cultures who thinks that it's rude to praise a woman for her beauty when you should be praising her for, you know, personality traits, like who she is as an actual human being, not just the genetics that she may have happened to be gifted with? Because they interpret you saying, oh, you know, your body is so beautiful. They interpret that. Their associations is you're saying her body is more important than who she is as a human being, than her brain, right? Her body is more important than her personality traits. So when you take a step back from maybe your own cultural norms, I mean, in reality, doesn't that actually make a little bit more sense? After all, why is it that most women, generally speaking, most women will admire a man for who he is? Not what he looks like, but most men will admire a woman for what she looks like. Now listen, I'm not trying to shame anyone here. I'm not trying to make anyone wrong. I'm not even trying to make a point on what you should compliment a woman on. The only point that I am trying to get across is that you don't actually want the stuff. Okay. You just want how that stuff, how you think that stuff will make you feel. You don't want the millions of dollars or the better body. You want how you think those things will make you feel. Everything will always come back to a feeling, because that's the only reality that we actually have, is inside our brain. That's the only reality that is relevant to us, is what's inside our brain. Okay, so let's say that you want more money. It's a common goal for most people. I'd imagine that a lot of people who are listening to this program probably want more money on some level or another. Well, on a very simple level, how do you affect that change? Step one, you may need to change your neuroassociations. Now, I don't know you personally, and I don't know what your personal situation is, but most people's minds are not programmed correctly to actually help them reach their centi-million-dollar goals or deca-million-dollar goals. So, step one, for the majority of you out there, is to change those brain associations, which will aid them and aid you in your journey. Okay, now, step two. Once again, this is for the majority of people out there. Changing your actions. Okay, and even for the minority of listeners who already have super strong positive associations to making large amounts of money or whatever your goal is, and they're already taking massive actions towards its achievement, hey, I think you guys would agree more than anyone that you can always do more and you can always have stronger neuroassociations to continue to help propel you even faster and further. Now, NLP is just one form of creating change. Of course, you can use many other forms of therapy, and virtually any form of therapy can work for some people some of the time. NLP is just a little bit of a shortcut, and it's a good one that you can do on your own, and it'll also speed up the process of change a little bit. It looks into other forms of therapy and says, hey, when does that change actually happen? So, let's say that you were in an abusive relationship and you went to Gestalt therapy. What would happen? Well, more likely than not, a Gestalt therapist would believe that a lot of the issues in your life are tied to that abusive relationship that you used to be in. So, they'll put you on a chair, and then they'll put another chair on the other side of the room, right? And the therapist, or not, you know, but in a couple feet in front of you, right? They'll put the other chair, that empty chair, and the therapist will tell you to look at that chair as if you were talking to your abusive ex. Imagine that your abusive ex is there, except this time, when you talk to your ex, you're the one in power. Okay, so then you'll turn to that chair and you'll say, no, okay, well, I don't like how you treated me. And then the therapist will say, no, no, you're in control. You tell him who's boss. And then you'll say, I don't like how you treated me. I deserve better than you. And what happens? For the very first time, you feel powerful when you're thinking about your ex. And then you repeat that process over and over, thinking about your ex, feeling in control, thinking of your ex, feeling powerful, thinking of your ex, feeling strong. And after a while, when you're at home and the memory of your ex comes up, your brain has been rewired enough to where you will no longer feel weak and insignificant. You'll feel powerful. Okay, so how about you went to person-centered therapy? Here, the therapist will likely create a safe zone for you and will be supportive of you and confident in your ability to overcome the issues that you're dealing with. You'll reflect back on your abusive relationship, and the therapist will have unwavering confidence that you'll realize these are unsupportive beliefs and that you will move on and live live a healthy life. And although these sessions are in a much different tone than Gestalt, the result is the same. While you're thinking about this negative memory, you have someone who is supporting you and feeding you positive thoughts. And that, over time, will rub off on you, and you will begin to adopt those positive, supporting beliefs. And then when you're at home and thinking about your ex, you'll maintain a positive attitude and not fall into your old destructive feelings. How about rational emotive behavioral therapy? Here, a therapist will likely make you question your own beliefs about your ex. See, of course, what happened to you may have been horrible, but often what sticks with people is the meaning we give to those situations. So if a person was abused, they may think that means that they are bad and worthless and they deserved it. They weren't good enough. An irrational emotive therapist will use the logical portion of your brain to call out those logic flaws and help you realize this was just some deranged and sick individual. So once again, by changing the meaning of the situation, we can then recall those memories without the same feelings of insecurity and worthlessness that we used to feel. How about psychoanalysis? This is the stereotypical scene you will see in a movie or show where a person is lying on a couch and the client says, "What do you think my ex-relationship means?" And the therapist will just repeat the question back to you. "What do you think it means?" This type of therapy tends to take a bit longer because it is a non-directive therapy, meaning the therapist isn't directing the client, only allowing him a space to reflect on his or her own thoughts. However, with enough reflection over time, the client generally will get to the right place one way or another and realize that he was either giving the memory an incorrect meaning, or after reviewing the memory for long enough, the memory simply loses its power over you. Think of it this way. Let's say that you have a fear of snakes, and somebody ties you down to a chair. Okay, so maybe this wouldn't happen in reality. or maybe in reality you could say, you know, they defang the snake or whatever, and then you could actually run a test like this, all right? But so you have a fear of snakes, and somebody ties, like you're in a torture chamber or one of those like electric shock, you know, where they're going to shock someone to death, like one of those types of chairs, and they tie you completely down to it so you can't move, and then somebody places a snake around your neck. Now, at first, will you be screaming your head off and trying to smash your way and thrash through the chair and get that snake away? Of course. I mean, assuming that you have a fear of snakes, you'll be trying to do anything that you can, but here's the thing. That takes a lot of energy, both physical energy and mental energy. And you're gonna, I mean, dude, your steam is gonna run out after a while. You can't act like that forever. And this snake is just gonna sit there, unaffected. That's the end of it. Nothing else. What's gonna happen after a long enough period of time? You'll stop being afraid of the snake. You can't be afraid of it forever. Your body physically cannot go through all of that trauma that you're putting it through, yelling and thrashing around and your stress levels rising and your muscles tensing. Your body will wear out and eventually you'll have no energy left to resist. Now, this process may take minutes, hours, or days, but it is inevitable. No one can live in a constant state of heightened fear for their entire life. Now, you may never lose 100% of your fear, but you'll lose the vast majority of it so you can live a normal day-to-day life. Well, you know, like tied down to a chair. I don't really know what that means. So look, I doubt any psychoanalysis therapist would be happy to compare their methods to locking a person in an execution chair and putting a snake around their neck. Obviously, this type of thing that's going on in the therapy sessions are taking place on a much, much smaller scale. But it's the same principle. Your body cannot physically be in a heightened state of fear or stress 100% of the time. So if you spend a large enough time reflecting back on something negative, eventually it will lose most of its power over you, and you can then begin to gain power over it. Now, what do these therapies have in common? Well, all of them use different methods, but the end result is the same. The person feels differently about the situation. The reality of the situation has not changed in any of them, right? The reality is still the same. What happened happened, and what's happening now is happening now. Okay, the only thing that has changed is how the person feels about the situation. That's why it's not as important what happens to us. That's outside of our sphere of influence. We don't want to focus on what we cannot control. That disempowers us. All that matters is how we feel about what happened to us. And whether or not you completely agree with this statement intellectually, you want to believe this at an emotional level, because how you feel about something is something that you can control and therefore is inside your sphere of influence. And you want to spend as much time as possible focusing on things which are inside your sphere of influence. Think of it this way. If all you focus on is what is outside of your control, there is a 100% chance that you will not be able to change it. Okay? I'm going to say it one more time. It's very basic. Okay? Don't overthink it. If all you're focusing on is what is outside of your control, then by definition, there is a 100% chance that you will not be able to change it. You cannot change the past, and there are certain situations which you cannot change. However, if you focus on what you can control, then there is a chance that you can change the situation for the better. Now, just because you focus